Welcome to the Dirt on Data podcast, where we explore how to unlock the data needed to transform agriculture for smallholder farmers around the world. Our co-hosts, Richard Charlatan and Drew Whedon, talk to the people, businesses, researchers, and visionaries leading the ag data revolution. Along with our partners and collaborators, we explore the creative new ideas and innovations that improve food security, build sustainable and inclusive food systems, and catalyze a vibrant agricultural data ecosystem.
Welcome to the Dirt on Data. I'm Richard Charlatan.
And I'm Drew Whedon.
We're so happy to be co-hosting this new podcast, where each month we explore the innovations shaping the future of crop analytics, bringing you the dirt on agricultural data.
We have a great panel for you today. We've brought together experts from across the data value chain to dig into some real issues at the intersection of smallholder agriculture and data.
We have a lot to cover, but before we get started, Drew, who are smallholder farmers?
That's a great question, Richard. Smallholder farmers, often referred to as small-scale producers, are defined in various ways that really depends on the context. Typically, small-scale farmers and pastoralists manage areas which vary from less than 1 hectare all the way up to about 10 hectares. Smallholder farming systems account for more than 80% of all farms worldwide, and they typically face pretty significant challenges around optimizing their yield for the crops that they're growing. So there's a lot of potential for improvements in productivity and in incomes.
Thanks, Drew. We've got a group of experts working with smallholder farmers to try and help them use agricultural data today to talk about where we are and where we're going. Enough from us. Let's hear from the guests.
Absolutely. Let's get started and welcome our first few guests. Lillian Ndugu, the Agriculture and Food Security Thematic Lead with the Regional Center for Mapping of Resources for Development, or RCMRD. Stuart Collis, Senior Program Officer for Digital Agriculture at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and Alicia Miller, Vice President of Strategy and Partnerships at Digital Green.
Lillian, Stuart, and Alicia, we know there's so much happening in digital agriculture at the moment for smallholder farmers. Why is agricultural data important, and how does it help smallholders overcome the challenges they face? First, let's hear from Lillian.
Thank you, Richard. So just to put this into context, we are looking at a continent of Africa where there are over 500 million smallholder farmers and who produce around 80% of the continent's food. And this makes up to more than 60% of the population in sub-Saharan Africa and a contribution to 23% of the GDP. With focused data and interventions informing agricultural development, Africa could produce 2 to 3 more tons of cereal and grains, which would add 20% more cereals and grains to the current worldwide 2.6 billion tons of output. So the point is, agriculture is one of the key drivers to achieving growth in the continent. Talk about industrial growth and any kind of development, the underpinning industry is agriculture. And improving agriculture is really data-driven decision-making. And so access to timely, consistent, accurate, and applicable data is the key to better decision-making across the entire value chain.
Thanks, Lillian. Stuart, what would you add to Lillian's response?
Thanks, Richard. Yeah, you know, when most people think about smallholder farmers, I think they have the impression that they just need to produce enough food to feed and sustain themselves and their families. But in reality, it's far more complicated than this. Without access to the latest information on best agricultural practices, they have difficulty obtaining credit because most credit lines are secured with collateral and they maybe don't own the land they're working. They have trouble obtaining insurance to cover disasters and loss, and they don't generally have equitable access to markets to get the best price for their produce. And this is, of course, exacerbated by climate change. So a problem these farmers are not responsible for creating, but is causing greater weather variability. It's, you know, changing rainfall patterns, varying temperatures, causing, you know, changes to traditional planting windows and timing of certain practices, dry spells, floods, new pests and diseases that are not normally seen in these in their fields. And so this just exacerbates the challenges they face.
Thanks, Stuart. Over to Alicia.
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think the first thing I would say is variability. We all know that our climate is getting far more variable, and better data is going to help us kind of keep pace with the pace of climate change. So at a high level, that's why it's so important. It's one of the main reasons. But then I think if you think about what does data mean, it's, you know, it's really information that you can glean insights from. And so when we think about why is that important? I think that ultimately this is an opportunity for farmers to use data to exchange amongst themselves and really understand how they can adapt. And then secondarily for service providers of farmers to do a better job delivering those services. And then of course, in the R&D space, really being able to stay apace on the R&D side so we can get in front of challenges that are being presented to farmers before it's upon them.
Thanks. Thanks to you all. I mean, I think that last point is really critical, that we have new techniques with machine learning and artificial intelligence and cloud computing to do analysis with remote sensing data that we've never been able to do before. What are some of the opportunities that improved data and crop analytics can provide smallholders? Alicia, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I think obviously the first one that comes to mind is being able to improve specific advisory messages using things like weather and soil data. And then thinking also about localization of recommendations. So something that comes to mind in Digital Green's wheelhouse is we were able to combine those pieces of data to really target messages to cashew farmers in India about cashew flower drop. And basically the timing of when you do certain practices has a direct result on how negative the cashew flower drop is for you after the fact. And so timing of the message is tied to various weather patterns. And so delivering those messages, saying now is the time to kind of undertake these practices, is an important example of where you can use outside data to kind of inform a specific action. And that's on the sort of advisory side, which is where there's just a ton of opportunity, especially around things like early warning for disease is another one. Being able to warn farmers of how diseases are progressing so that they can actually take preventative action and also signal the arrival of disease so that it can help other farmers. So those are some specific examples on the production side. But I think there's also an interesting set of examples on more of the market side, which is, you know, we often think about how this information can improve the farmer experience. But a lot of other actors in the ag ecosystem want information like yield prediction so that they can do a better job of offering financial services or do a better job kind of reducing transaction costs in marketing of surplus, right? So there are people that are interested in improving the way that they do business with farmers, which could ultimately lead to more profitability and sort of smoothing across the ag ecosystem that also care about these kinds of analytics.
Thanks, Alicia. Over to Stuart.
Yeah, I mean, with digital tools comes the opportunity for two-way data flows. So we can both provide services to farmers, but we can also obtain data about those farmers. So let me give a really specific example. So if a farmer has forewarning of a pending drought or a drier than normal season, rather, yeah, they could source drought-tolerant varieties that would be more appropriate for that seasonal condition. They could also purchase a bundled insurance policy with that drought tolerant variety to cover their risk. However, the service provider needs to be able to design that policy to that, you know, farmer or to their sort of environmental conditions, their agroecology. And even before that, researchers, in order for them to develop a new variety for that region, they have to have information about how the current crops are performing in that agroecology and how that's changing over time with climate change. So this is where, you know, data about the farm field and farm practices and yields is really critical. I mean, there's thousands of similar ways in which data can help improve the livelihoods of small scale producers. So, you know, that's what I'm excited about is, you know, I know that's a long-winded way of saying this, but super excited about some of the new innovative data sources and data collection methods we have in combination with, you know, how we can integrate, analyze that data, use it to tailor services for the benefit of small-scale producers.
Thanks, Stuart. Let's hear from Lillian.
Thank you, Richard. Structuring the data to make sure that it's accessible to the right people is important. Women who might not necessarily own land, but who do the bulk of the farming activities, are more invested in the resilience and food security at farm level because it has a direct implication on the ability to put a meal on the table for their children consistently throughout the year. Localized recommendations and data that is gender sensitive and language sensitive and time specific is important. And simply saying that it's going to rain is not enough. And the data landscape needs to connect the dots from the farmers to government to micro-learning facilities, input providers, and markets. And in developing of systems, the first thing that is required is ground data. And so everything that is required to transform the African agriculture is actually based on the availability and quality of data that is being used to make decisions and to develop systems.
Thank you all for sharing some of the challenges that are facing smallholder farmers and how data can help to overcome those challenges. We will hear more from Lillian and Alicia in a moment, but their last points about structuring agricultural data and how to best collect that data really dovetails well into our next topic as we take a deeper dive specifically into ground truth training data, what that looks like, how it's best collected and shared. We know that there's a good amount of ground truth data out there, but people can't always access it. In some cases, organizations that are generating this data are not willing to share it. In other cases, it's just not easy to find. Tali Kilich, senior economist with the World Bank, Sander Johnson, team leader of Earth Informatics at Wageningen University, and Stuart again, will tell us more about how good training data is captured, collected, and used to enable some of the solutions that Alicia, Lillian, and Stuart have just mentioned. Hi, Talib and Sander. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Drew. Good to be with you. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. And I think it's really nice to dive into this question of data sharing and why organizations are sharing or not sharing it.
Excellent. So before we get into the specifics of data sharing, I do just want to ask a more wide open question, I guess, which is, what does good ground truth training data look like? How can we make it easier to find, access, and use? Let's start with you, Stuart.
Well, it depends. I think it depends on the use case. You know, if ground truth data is being collected for, you know, a very approximate estimate of regional food security, you know, for a UN agency or a government agency, that would be quite different than, you know, say if you were designing a very field-specific, farmer-specific crop insurance payout threshold model. So, you know, the quality of that data, the accuracy of that data, the methodology used to collect it is really going to depend on the application you're using that data for. So, you know, traditionally we've relied on crop cuts as being the gold standard, and there's even variation within that category. But with new technologies, you know, I think there's opportunities to apply some of these innovative methodologies to, you know, look at using cell phones, smartphones, photographs, videos, drones, you know, LiDAR on tablet to create 3D models of crop stands.
Great. Thanks, Stuart. Those are fantastic examples. Tali, would you like to add anything?
Yeah, thanks, Drew. You know, the answer to your question has many layers. And if you're thinking about accurate training data collection on the ground, we ought to be thinking of minimizing in measurement errors that typically creep up in household survey operations, for instance, that are promising sources of these training data. So good training data are accurate training data that are collected with validated survey methods that minimize measurement errors in a way that limits other biases and measurement errors in downstream applications like Earth observation applications that rely on this data. Good training data has to be fit for purpose. Not every accurate data set may be collected with the right methods. Good training data also has to be data that is timely. that reflects the timing of activities that we're intending to capture on the ground. And for agriculture, for instance, this is of utmost importance because there are certain activities throughout the agricultural season that we would like to specifically capture data on, say during planting or between planting and harvest or post-harvest, that dictates when exactly you ought to be collecting that data. Good training data is also data that is documented well. As a community, we ought not to be collecting data for just a single application. We ought to be recognizing the value of data through its repeated use. So if a researcher is coming in and trying to work with a data set that I had my hands on, that I had a hand in collecting, he or she needs to understand how these data are collected. So without the metadata, without the documentation of the methods that were used, as well as the experience with the implementation of these methods, we cannot achieve the full potential of the data in front of us because we may not understand well.
Great, thanks, Dalit. So I think that you've already addressed this to some extent, but I will still ask it in case there's anything else you want to highlight, which is, you know that there's a huge amount of data out there already, some of which is even collected as training data, but it can't all be used for every purpose, as you've already said. So could you talk a little bit maybe about some of the challenges that people face, whether it's in the actual collection methodology or perhaps, you know, trying to apply a data set to the wrong sort of solution? Is there anything you'd want to expand upon from what we've already talked about in that regard?
Yeah, thanks, Drew. If I may take a step back, I do hear this phrase about a lot of data being collected, a lot of data being potentially available, a lot of data being potentially useful that are maybe sitting somewhere right now that we cannot access and get appropriate use out of. I think understanding of how much data sits where, collected when, and for what purpose, and obviously this kind of it goes back to the question of, you know, retaining repositories of these training data that are documented well. I think this is one area where we do need to understand better, just generally around availability of data. Yeah. So a second order question, as you have alluded to, is the utility of the available data. So as we know, unless data are documented well, we may not necessarily know their utility for specific applications.
Thanks, Dalit. And now let's hear from Sander.
Hey, Drew. I think the crucial point there is that we need to understand how ground truth data helps to make better services. So ground truth data in itself is a validation data set that you use to check whether your analytic products really work. And you don't need a lot of it, but you need some of it. And now we have not enough of it. So we need a sample of ground truth data to make a service for everybody. And I think we didn't have enough of an understanding of this in the past. So a lot of data was collected, but nobody really shared in any structured way. So it's just sitting in somebody's computer. And we need to, you know, break open these silos, change ways of working of people in, so that they share this data, and that also analytical companies, other universities, governments can make use of it and develop better services for the smallholders. I mean, so the ground truth data is like a building block for the digital service, and that then helps the smallholder. It's not that the ground truth data directly will help the smallholder.
Yeah, thank you. Can we talk more about the data silos that you mentioned, Sander? Why do they exist, and what are some of the ways we can break them down?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, these silos. I mean, traditionally, you could say that people in science and innovation were more or less with their own small community. So if you were, let's say, researching maize, then you knew the 10 other people researching maize in a smallholder environment. Between them, you could share data by email. So like, what's this data set? But now with the advance of remote sensing and models and all these exciting products and companies, so we need a shift in mindset from this old way of working to this new way of working. I see this data as a type of public good. So I think the more of this data we have, we can all use for the benefit of everyone.
Great. Thank you. I heard all three of you talk about the need for standards to enable interoperability of these data sets and to help break down some of the silos between them, as Sandra put it. I think it's a good transition into a question specifically about standards and guidelines for this kind of data. What are the best practices for capturing this idea of the representativeness of data? And are there emerging guidelines that you think are really promising in terms of data capture methodology that you'd like to see further promoted or that you think already are being promoted at scale? Stuart, let's start with you again, please.
Yeah, I mean, standards play a role in a lot of industries. If you can agree on a standard and it's a appropriately designed standard, then it can really unlock data fluidity, you know, in a sector. So it enables easier integration of data systems. It allows standardization. It really allows, you know, aggregation too, because you know, if you have 20 different organizations collecting the same type of information in a slightly different way, then it's very hard to aggregate that up into a meaningful prediction or into an aggregate model or assessment of food security, let's say. So, you know, standards play a role. I think we have to be careful not to over-index on standards. We've seen lots of efforts over the years where standard may be over-designed or over-engineered for the application. You have to find that right balance between having enough of a standard that enables the interoperability objectives you have, but isn't overbearing such that it just doesn't get adopted. So, you know, there's some efforts underway, like, the FAIR data principles, you know, findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable. Mostly that's in the research world. So both CABI and the CGIAR in the agriculture space have been exploring this. At the Gates Foundation, we've been funding some of those efforts. We have some interesting ideas around, you know, how do you develop out for agriculture, you know, things like data sharing protocols or Digital Green Farm Stack is one example, or Linux Foundation are working with AgStack. There's groups like in the US, like FarmOS and Open Team and GEMS that are all, you know, trying to develop standard ways of organizing, structuring, tagging this type of data. I think there's a lot of exciting things happening in this space.
Thanks, Stuart. Sander, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of technical barriers you could see. People collect different data points when they do trials in the field or visit a farmer, and you need to somehow get this together. We worked on this with an initiative called AgroStack that's collecting these field trials for crop growth across the globe. And we just saw, I mean, even if tens of years of data experiments have been carried out, the data is really difficult to find. We need to put all these heterogeneous data sets together. And then you lose a lot of data because you can just focus on the minimum that they all have in common somehow. That's an issue, but it shouldn't be an excuse.
That's a great way to put it, an issue, but not an excuse. I like it. Okay, any other incentives or disincentives, that either drive or inhibit data sharing that we haven't talked about yet that you want to bring up?
Yeah, with AgroStack, what we want to do is have this institutional commitment from large players in this field. Radiant Earth, that's a good example. And hopefully that helps to get more data and add also other institutions to it who can, work as a consortium. So it's not that we as Wageningen want to say, it's all data, you have to pay for it, but we want to work with it as a common good, and hopefully more institutions will join our initiative and make sure that we keep this data available for everybody to do the analytics on.
Thank you, Sander. And now over to Tali.
I think this is a very important question because, you're highlighting an area where generation of global public goods in the form of research, in the form of knowledge, can actually solve constraints for many interested parties and stakeholders that are kind of interested in working in this space. So when we think about standards and guidelines, I would like people to understand that these standards and guidelines have to be anchored in research. I would also say that, you know, there's quite a bit of work that we ought to be doing in promoting the adoption of these standards and guidelines, right? So in a sense, that is the last mile we need to overcome. I think there's buzz around this, right? As you know, and maybe other listeners know, as part of the 50 by 30 initiative, we have started this work, basically understanding the minimum requirements for large-scale household and farm surveys in order to inform downstream, say, earth observation applications for high-resolution crop area and crop yield mapping. Even then, our focus is on large-scale surveys conducted by national statistical offices, and our focus is on cereal crops and on two specific applications. And as you can see, you know, earth observation is an ocean, right? It's an ocean of applications. It's an ocean of, say, potential directions in which, you know, we could leverage ground data and satellite imagery. And there's so much more to know and advise on, as we suspect that ground data requirements, you know, will be different, again, depending on the application. So unless we do that rigorous work, and unless, you know, that is done, perhaps in a more coordinated fashion, perhaps we're not achieving the impact that we could possibly achieve in terms of integrating surveys and satellites.
We've heard from Stuart, Talib, and Sander about why this work is important, what good training data looks like, and how it is or is not shared. Ultimately, these data are not helpful if they're not translated into useful insights and analytics for end users, particularly smallholder farmers, extension agents, or governments who are trying to make decisions about food security. We've invited Lillian Ndugu and Alicia Miller to tell us more about how they have seen the power of advanced analytics applied in different areas like smart farming applications and food security monitoring responses. We also want to welcome our final guest, Lisa Schrader. Lisa is an expert in digital agriculture, financial services, strategy, and financial inclusion. She is joining us to talk about improved access to digital financial services. Welcome, Lisa.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Lisa, Alicia, and Lillian, can you name some of the most interesting, exciting, or promising digital applications that you've seen using advanced crop analytics that are already out there or just starting to emerge? What are you most excited about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that using satellite data to measure carbon capture is super exciting. You know, we're starting to see different players work with investors and farmer-facing organizations in the field to be able to combine satellite data and field validation data in different models to understand carbon capture over time, and to be able to, in a meaningful way, compensate farmers for carbon capture. So, you know, that creates a whole different dynamic, a whole different way of building incentives for farmers to pursue climate smart agriculture. But it requires huge amounts of data and the ability to monitor that data over time. So it requires boots on the ground of microfinance institutions or extension officers, investors and lenders, and it requires, you know, the satellite and sensor data to all be engaged.
Thanks, Lisa. Really, really interesting. Over to Alicia.
Sure. So some things we're working on that I'm excited about. We have an application called Kisan Diary Enterprise, which is actually working with farmer organizations to better track what kinds of product their members have available, and to also track input demand so that they can actually purchase in an aggregated form. We're excited about the idea of farmer organizations themselves being able to leverage that data for better services, you know, better prices on inputs, or being able to compete their volumes with different buyers. And also excited about how that allows them to kind of learn collectively. Another thing that I find exciting in that space is that we're also thinking about consent management in the context of this. So we're introducing a consent manager layer in that app so that farmers actually understand what data is being collected, why, and what it means to give consent. And we're using kind of a video-based interface for that. And it's early days for us, but I think that's something I'd like to see us moving towards, I think, as a sector, is how do we think about consent within these applications? And then the other component that we're thinking about, but it's not just us, we know of a lot of other actors thinking about this, including in the US and other locations around the world, is thinking about data wallets, a farm data wallet. So, you know, farmers get asked to relay the same information over and over again, plot boundary, crop center production, practice data, you know, information, transaction information. It's not only burdensome, but it also makes it difficult for them to switch service providers if they wanted to. And so there's this idea of forming of like a farmer or farm data wallet, which we're initially thinking about at the organization level, actually, because not every farmer is yet at the place where that's going to be accessible. But in other places, people are thinking about it very much at the farm level. How do we capture the data once or use kind of real-time data that's being collected to be always up to date in a farm data wallet so that that can be shared securely with different service providers each time, but not collected and gathered by lots of different stakeholders? So I'm excited about this idea of it's converging around a data wallet. I also like the agency that that brings. So those are a few. And then I'd point to another thing that I'm excited about that I'm only just learning about, so I can't go into detail, but Acre Africa, which I've respected the work they do for a long time in the insurance space, I've learned recently that they're doing more on picture-based insurance. I would love to see more innovations using pictures. And my understanding is that they're having farmers take photos from the exact same spot and kind of training farmers and training the app to make it easy to kind of photograph the crops as they mature. I love the idea of reducing the cost of gathering that ground truth data and not having it be, you know, agents that have to go out and collect it, but really helping farmers to generate that data. And pictures and voice feel like the right place to start with that. So I'm excited to see that innovation. Would love to see others ramping up using photo and voice data collection too.
Thanks. Great points. Let's hear from Lillian.
Thank you, Richard. I think it's an exciting time to be in technology and also having a really, you know, good understanding of the agricultural landscape. And one of the things that I can say is most exciting is the shift that we are seeing now and that has informed our development from systems that tell us what is happening now to systems that are more robust and which are providing an indication of what is going to happen in the next 1 month or 6 weeks, so that more proactive decisions can be made. One of such predictive systems is an automated rangeland decision support tool that is incorporating 6 week forecasts of the rangeland conditions, the pasture conditions, and supporting the National Drought Management Authority and the Kenya Red Cross in planning and mitigation of drought-related losses. With such information, 6 weeks early, the populations that are at risk because of drought can be mapped, and the budget required as well as intervention measures can be put in place to reduce the amount of loss in livestock and in human lives that is otherwise experienced when decisions are being made from information, from current information. The other most, one of the most innovative systems that we have developed is a sensor plus hydrological forecasting system in Malawi. And this is a system that is providing advance warning to communities through SMS to community leaders once the flood forecast system triggers a warning, providing an indication of the lead time before the flood reaches the communities and allowing them to evacuate and get into safety. RCMRD, through collaborations with other institutions around the world, have developed a yield forecasting system that is automated and providing data-driven insights to Kenya's national food balances and supporting the management of food stocks in the country by the Ministry of Agriculture in Kenya, as well as a collaborative contribution towards development of regional food balance sheet systems that is being supported by AGRA and universities such as the University of Maryland and Tetra Tech. But in terms of data collection systems, we've seen a shift again from the traditional data collection systems to more hybrid systems that either have sensors on the ground or, you know, systems such as the helmets, GoPro cameras that are supporting rapid data collection to inform training of machine learning based systems and allowing for rapid and scalable monitoring of the croplands.
Thanks. Those are great examples. There's lots of exciting innovation out there. You've talked about some of the services for smallholders. improved access to finances, and innovations to improve food security, decision-making, and monitoring. Why do you think those are particularly successful and exciting examples? And what's it going to take to scale them up in more countries, for more crops, and to support more farmers? Let's start off with Alicia.
I think there are a few things that come to mind. The first one that just really stands out is the really good solutions have thought about the incentives for the farmer to participate, the incentives for the service, like how strong is the need for that service and what's the ask to deliver that service well? How much data, how easily can farmers give that data if it's, you know, via voice or photo? I think really good services are thinking about what's the incentive and how much is the value that I'm delivering? Is it worth it for that farmer? And then the other piece I would put out here that with Digital Green, we're thinking about a lot more is when we think about applications for small scale producers, a lot of these people are going to be coming into digital technology for the first time, or they're in early stages of being in the digital realm. How do we make that an exciting experience, an empowering experience, and not one that is frustrating, where you maybe don't feel as smart using it? So that's the other piece, is like recognizing when we use a new piece of technology, if it's not elegant and easy and meeting me where I am, I think people are likely to disadopt. And then maybe one last thing, thinking about existing platforms and how we link them together. So we know that people don't want to have one app for input buying and one app for selling and one app to think about insurance products. But how do we build infrastructure that links those things together or makes it easier for those service providers to share data or delivers more value so that the farmer isn't having this very fractured experience? And so, you know, we use something like WhatsApp for some of our advisory work. That's a platform that the vast majority of Indians have on their phone. And I think, again, thinking about how do we meet farmers where they are and how do we make that process easy is part of the success factors.
Thanks, Alicia. Lillian, over to you.
Thank you, Richard. I think that's a loaded question and it has so many dimensions to it. And the first thing that I'd like to say before I leave the point is that the quality of these systems that I've mentioned is actually based on quality ground data. Now, in terms of the elements that have driven success to this, I'd like to say the first thing is that, and which we often forgot to mention, is that most of these require a lot of investment to develop the infrastructures. And the other thing is we adopt a co-development platform or environment that is backed by a sound service planning, engagement, and monitoring protocols. So it means that systems respond to their specific needs. The other thing is the need to develop sensitive systems. So sensitive enough to respond to not just the needs, but the capacities of the users. If you're talking about government, it doesn't matter how heavy the kind of background system is, the interface that we present has to be simplified enough for them to use it consistently. It cannot be complicated. It needs to be simplified and responding to specific data and information needs. And also the issue of automation. So for most of these services, they're time sensitive in terms of the data requirements and information. The timeliness of the information is actually key. And so we focus on systems that can be automated or semi-automated to make sure that the delivery of this data is really timely, because that is key to trust in these systems. It doesn't matter the challenges at the back end, these systems need to be stable. And so consistency and systems that are sound is really important.
Thanks, all. We've talked about some of the challenges and what makes success. Where are the critical gaps that you see in the digital ecosystem? Challenges that we all need to overcome so that we can see more of these applications helping smallholders around the world. What are your thoughts, Lisa?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there are two major gaps that come to mind. Number one, which is something I know you guys wrestle with a lot, is just the data gap itself. So you see a lot of great actors in the field, like One Acre Fund, reaching, you know, well in excess of 1 million farmers. and they'd like to go digital, but they don't have digital data on their farmers right now. And so, you know, I think one of the gaps is getting really great validated geotagging information and being able to capture that. One Acre Fund is now talking with the Kenyan government about being able to use their geotag data. So that kind of a role for government could be a game changer. If governments can collect and update and share good solid geotag data on farmers, that could advance the sector in major ways, because there's no reason for everyone to go out and geotag the exact same farmers over and over and over again. But another big gap that I do see is on the financial institution side. And this has been accelerated by things like the pandemic, things like climate change, where a lot of the lenders that we see really want to go digital to deal with the increasing risk that they have and that they face, and the increasing cost in the time of pandemic of, you know, they can't get out to the farmers, they can't validate things. But they run into a real gap in the policy arena, where central banks are not comfortable with the use of digital agronomic data as a proxy for credit scoring. So, you know, that we've come a long way on credit scoring with digital ag data. We know that it's indicative. We know that it serves an important role. But a lot of the times, regulators in different countries will not accept it as a valid form of credit risk management. And so they require the financial institutions to maintain large balances or large reserves that serve as a disincentive for the banks to engage. So I think there is work to be done with regulators. If we want investment to flow into the farmers, we need to clear that pathway.
I would summarize these as the need for data, the need for ground data, the need for a level of harmonization in our standards and methods, and the need to rethink the way we view the smallholder landscape as in general, and kind of focus on the advantages that can be leveraged even with such a fragmented ecosystem, to strengthen the production system. Thank you.
Thank you. We have one last question and want to open this one up for all of our guests. Looking 10 years into the future, what's the one thing you would like to be able to do with these technologies and applications that you can't do today to address the problems that you're trying to solve today or those that you see coming?
I guess I'd just say, you know, keep the financial sector in mind. A lot of the times when we look at these kind of advanced analytics, we're thinking more about, you know, direct advisory services or, you know, how we might serve policy goals for the food security. But this exact same data is extremely relevant for the financial sector. What we're seeing is advanced analytics being used from the very beginning all the way through the growing cycle and all the way through the harvest cycle, when many financial institutions are starting to tailor loan products that help farmers through the harvest. You know when the harvest is coming, inject that capital so they can hire a truck, so they can hire a tractor, so they can engage with a post-harvest loss facility. There's an entire way that credit risks and even better credit products can be hitting farmers and really increasing their productivity, their income, and then their resilience. So even though these are two sides of the analytics ecosystem that don't necessarily always talk to each other, it is really important for these sides of the ecosystem to engage and to find common language and to use the same data points. Again, there's no reason to recreate the wheel. If that data is there, let's use it across silos and let's use it for impact.
I come from a smallholder community, so I kind of want to see my village using a lot of technologies. What I'd want to see is mechanized agriculture. It doesn't matter the level of fragmentation. I want to see agriculture in Africa being less labor intensive and data driven and, you know, simple things. I'd want to see us developing very responsive systems that are localized enough to make localized suggestions, allowing farmers to do agriculture in a less labor intensive and more profitable way. I'd want to contribute to that initiative. I would say both at the technical development, but I also think that it's a policy issue, and I'd really want to be more active in developing usable solutions.
Thanks everyone for those insights. During this episode, we've talked with experts working on advanced analytics and digital services for smallholder farmers and the food systems that they operate within. We've learned what quality ground truth data is in this context, why the data are pivotal for the entire agricultural ecosystem, and what current trends and improvements are occurring within the collection and sharing of these data. We've grounded advanced analytic technologies in some of their many end use cases and applications, both in the field and at higher levels. In the rest of this podcast series, you'll hear from individual organizations pushing the innovative boundaries in both technologies and partnership models, as each month we dig into the dirt on data. Tune in next time to hear from Dr. Molly Brown from Sixth Grain, as she details how her team is forging innovative agricultural data sharing partnerships across Sub-Saharan Africa. Thank you.
The Dirt on Data is produced by the staff of Tetra Tech's Enabling Crop Analytics at Scale initiative and supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Our special thanks to our hosts, Richard and Drew, and to our many guests this week, Lillian Ndugu, Alicia Miller, Sander Johnson, Talib Kilich, Stuart Cullis, and Lisa Schrader. You can follow the ECAST project on Twitter to receive the latest and greatest news at ECAST_AgData, or visit our website at cropanalytics.net.